everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the geek show's dedicated books and arts and everything else related to the arts show, podcast, thing, broadcast, even. I can do words. Don't you thumbs up me. Don't you thumbs up me, you filthy biscuit eater. If you're wondering what that sound is, that's Andrew.
We have biscuits today and it's amazing.
Yes, he's eating biscuits. Anyway, right. Yes. That's Andrew with a face full of biscuits. Anyway, before we go any further, let's get some quick blurb out the way. The Geek Show Podcast Network, that's what we're on, and it's a voluntary organization, so if you can, please show your support. We have a GoFundMe campaign running at the moment, so share it around with people. If you want to make a donation to that, then, you know, we'd more than welcome any donations to that. And, yeah, we also have a shop on the website, thegeekshow.co.uk, where you can find all sorts of interesting merchandise that we actually design ourselves.
Yes, we do, with our own thinky brains.
Yes, we do. So you have a mouth not full of biscuits.
Yes, I very covertly swallowed my biscuit while you were doing the blurb.
Yes, then that's not a euphemism. Anyway, Literary Loitering is available on the website as well, but it's also on Mixcloud and very, 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 very soon iTunes and Stitcher and various other places. It's also on YouTube as well. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. Or you can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Google+, on MyAnimeList, and various other places. So we're everywhere. Anyway, I am Rob, and today I will be joined by the wonderful, as always, Andrew. Unfortunately, today he is a filthy biscuit eater.
Yes, so, I am.
Yes.
I may or may not be periodically ramming more biscuits into my face as the show goes on.
We do have, on the shop, we actually have a mug that says you're a filthy biscuit eater.
Yes, we do.
So we're going to see about getting you one of those.
I should have a filthy biscuit eater mug.
Anyway, right. So what have we got in the news then?
Okay. First up, we have got the news that the London Library has rediscovered a bunch of old Victorian pamphlets.
Okay.
And they are going to be releasing them.
Okay.
So first up, they've got a few ones on cycling that they're going to lump together into a single thing.
Yeah.
So they've got Cycling, the Craze of the Hour.
Okay.
His Last Pupil, which is about a cycling instructor who can't ride a bike. And my favourite, Cycling as a Cause of Heart Disease.
Sorry, what?
Cycling as a Cause of Heart Disease.
Cycling as a Cause of Heart Disease?
Yes.
And this was Victorian, was it?
This was Victorian.
Was this because of all the smog and stuff like that, because of the Industrial Revolution, or because...
Well, no, because, like, it's great, they've got illustrations of them, and I can see why it's a cause of heart disease.
Why?
I would assume it's, like, all the heart attacks from being, like, 7 feet off the ground on gigantic wheels.
Were these heart attacks caused by falling off them?
Probably.
Oh, yes, the penny farthings.
Great. I love that the illustration is, like, two guys with gigantic handlebar mustaches and penny farthings.
Yes.
Okay, so there's the cycling one. But the one that really caught my eye is the releasing a bunch that they did on travelling to Norway. So, see, it's called The Lure of the North.
Okay.
And it offers such handy advice as, if you give anything to a Norwegian, in brackets, old meat tins are always thankfully received, he will give you a hand, a silent grip more expressive than many words.
What? What?
The Brovary is a very pretty glacier and well worth the climb, but a simple walk across the Fuglefond entails much labour, and at the end one feels inclined to give Mr. Punch's celebrated advice. Don't. There's a travel guide that like tells you, yeah, you can walk here, but it's a lot of effort, so don't bother. Like, I think that's going to be like the entirety of the Andrew Young walking book I'm going to produce.
Oh, I don't know.
Anyway, what makes this even better is that there's another guide called Unprotected Females in Norway by Emmeline Lowe.
What?
Unprotected Females in Norway, and it has like one of the greatest lines I've ever seen. The only use of a gentleman in travelling is to look after the luggage, and we take care to have no luggage.
I don't know how to respond to this. Victorians had some very, very strange ideas.
Oh, no. The collection, which will be followed up with further 6 books in November, also includes features on corpulence. This include William Banting's 1864 Letter on Corpulence, a 19th century dieting book that encouraged readers to cut out milk, sugar, butter, and potatoes.
Okay. Milk, sugar, butter, and potatoes. Actually, when you think about it, it's actually not a bad idea.
But I just love this, that it's got Letters on Corpulence.
Yep.
I want that as like a new dieting show.
Letters and Corpulence. Is this like Points of View? Dear BBC, I found your dieting tips to be most helpful. I have lost 27 of my 28 stone, and now I am about to lose signs of life. Thank you very much for helping me get thin.
Why don't we use the word corpulence anymore, Rob?
I think it's because the people look at it and go, my brain can't even spell that. It's true. Most people can't spell corpulence.
No, they can't. I was just looking at some of the other ones. Is it the Gentlewoman's Book of Sports, Life in a Bustle, Advice to Youth and on Reading, Writing and Living with Books.
Life in a Bustle?
Yeah. Life in a Bustle.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Lewis Carroll wrote another thing called Feeding the Mind. I wonder if there's such a thing in nature as a fat mind.
Oh.
I really think I've met with one or two minds which could not keep up with the slowest trot in conversation, could not jump over a logical fence to save their lives, always got stuck fast in a narrow argument, and in short were fit for nothing but to waddle helplessly through the world.
Oh my God, I want this in my life. I want this in my life because it describes so many people that I know, and now I want to make a cap that just says fat mind, but PH.
In like the proper 90s graffiti style writing.
Yes. Yes, I want this. I want this though. It is basically hitting the nail on the head. There are so many people that we both know.
Yes. Oh my
who have
God.
Fat minds. And now I have a new insult.
No, we need to combine
Thank you,
them.
Lewis Carroll.
Maybe we need to go one step further than Lewis Carroll.
What?
You, sir, have a corpulent mind.
Ooh. No, a rotund mind. Because both of them end in ND, so have a little bit of similarity between the words.
I like it.
Yes, rotund. I love that word, rotund, as well.
It is. It's such a fun word.
It's a fun word to say, rotund. And
just,
when
it
you
literally
call someone,
rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Well, rotund. Yeah, and when you call someone rotund, they look at you like, I don't know what that means, but I'm sure it's insulting. It's like corpulent. Most people don't know what corpulent means, but they're sure it's insulting.
Well, especially when, like, you or I say it.
Yes.
Robert Andrew has said a word. It must be insulting.
Yes. That's happened to me quite a lot. I think it's because when I'm being on the ball and when I'm speaking to somebody that I've met for the first time, I tend to pronounce my T's, which in this area is not the done thing. And I
no,
say
sorry,
things,
I've learned.
And I say things like, it's not the done thing.
I was dressed in your long coat and your frilly necktie.
Exactly. Because I am a libertine.
Sorry, good sir, but it is not the good done thing. Now excuse me while I catch this hansom cab.
Yes. No, ride away slowly on your penny farthing.
No, Rob. Because that's the leading cause of heart disease.
Okay, we're going to have too much fun with this story, so let's let's move on.
Put this toy back in the box.
Yes, we've got other toys that we need to play with later on. All right, so what's next?
Drop back in on the Hugo Awards.
Okay, what's happening in the Hugo Awards? Hang on, haven't the Hugo Awards already happened?
Well, yeah, I think, but this is the shortlist for this year's Hugo Awards. I think we talked about them last year.
Yeah, because there was all that thing with sad puppies and rabid puppies.
Yes, and the two groups. Basically, sad puppies is a group we talked about last year who see science fiction as moving in a very left-wing, overly intellectual way.
I don't see anything wrong with the overly intellectual part.
You know, well, for sad puppies, they feel like they want more just flat-out fun books to be nominated, which, that's okay.
Yeah.
I think rabid puppies is the group we have more of a problem with, because they're the ones who are like, oh, no.
Aren't they the racist ones?
Yeah, they are basically the racist a-holes.
Yeah.
But okay. Anyway, they've been up to their tricks again, and they've kind of managed to take over the nominations list for the Hugo Awards.
Sorry, what?
Yeah. So now, this prestigious award ceremony will be choosing from a shortlist, which now includes SJWs Always Lie, an essay about social justice warriors by rabid puppies campaign leader Vox Day, My Little Pony cartoon The Cutie Map.
Okay.
And self-published parody erotic dinosaur fiction, Space Raptor Butt Invasion by Chuck Tingle.
That can't be his real name.
It is his pen name, though.
Chuck Tingle?
Yes, Chuck Tingle. Have you not heard of our Lord and Savior Chuck Tingle?
No.
He writes the most amazingly titled books. So he has one called Pounded in the Butt by My Own Butt, which he then followed up with a sequel, Pounded in the Butt by My Own Book, Pounded in My Own Butt by My Own Butt. And then followed that up with a sequel, Pounded in My Own Butt by My Own Book, Pounded in My Own Butt by My Own Book, Pounded in My Butt by My Own Butt.
This is good.
And then he followed that up with a sequel.
This has gone very, very Inception.
Oh, he also has a book called Buttception.
Is he inordinately fascinated with the butt, with his own butt?
Yes, he is.
Because, as you said, the one he's got here on the short story one is Space Raptor Butt Invasion.
Yes, oh, and I forgot the best one.
What?
Pounded in My Own Butt by My Own Concept of Linear Time. That's an actual book title that he has written.
Okay. Not sure how that works.
Well, there's only one way to find out.
Ah. So is the sequel to that one going to be Pounded in My Own Butt by Temporal Paradoxes?
See, you say that as a joke, but yes, that is entirely likely.
Okay. Remind me not to read any of Chuck Tingle's books. Please, please, please explain where the name Chuck Tingle comes from. It sounds too much like a euphemism to me.
Well, yeah, Rob, that's like 100% what it is.
Okay.
Because when you read his books, you get a tingle in your chuck.
Okay. Not going there, but okay. Ah, some of these other ones, just, I don't know. The first draft of My Appendix N book by Jeffro Johnson.
That's one of the serious ones.
Is it?
I would assume so.
What about this? Well, if this is in best related work, by Daniel Ennis, Safe Space as Rape Room. That doesn't sound too attractive.
No, that's...
Yeah, no.
I mean, to be fair, at least it seems like the best novel nominations are still fairly serious.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ones...
Ooh.
What?
Seven Eves is nominated for Best Novel.
Ooh, definitely. One of the ones that caught my attention in the Best Graphic Story, Full Frontal Nerdity. I like that title.
I love it.
By Aaron Williams. That one's caught my attention. But Seven Eves being in there, that's... yeah, okay. I have nothing else to finish this off with, so...
Nah, so I'm hoping this doesn't become, like, a big problem in the future.
I don't know, because this is one of those things that it can be a flash in the pan, but if the Hugo Awards say or do the wrong thing, it becomes much bigger than it actually should have been.
Yeah, I think that is the problem, is you don't draw too much attention to it.
Yeah, I think the attention that's being drawn to it by the other authors, okay, fine. I just think the Hugo Awards should basically just go along business as usual and ignore rabid puppies and sad puppies and what's going on. And basically, whatever nominations are put in front of them, just be professional and basically pick it based on the best one that's put in front of them, regardless of who's put it there. Just keep going through the same process, because the second they start picking apart the process, that's when they're going to come into a lot of criticism from everybody.
Yeah, well, plus, I mean, groups like this, what they're doing it for the attention.
Yeah.
So you take that away from them, they're going to fizzle out and die. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. With groups like this, generally, it's better not to ignore a problem when a problem occurs, because most of the time they don't go away. But in this case...
Yeah, this is one of those rare cases where it does actually work.
Yeah, just ignore them. Don't worry. Sand in the wind, that's what they are.
Nicely done.
Yes. Anyway.
Yes, I assume you have some sort of storiness for us to talk about.
Yes, I was about to move on to a kingly statue overlooking Tintagel Castle, which has been put there, or helicoptered there, but has kind of inflamed the Arthurian row, or the row about Tintagel Castle, that's been going on for a while between English heritage and Cornish nationals and historians. Right. It's this regal figure that's called Galos, which is the Cornish word for power, and it's of a older man with a beard and a hooded cloak. He's got crown on the cloak, and he's kind of holding a sword in front of him. It's kind of an incomplete statue type thing, incomplete bronze statue. And it's so heavy, it had to be helicoptered there. And the guy who owns that part of that plot of land is a guy called Matt Ward. And he basically said, it's brilliant, isn't it? I think the visitors are going to love it. Imagine it when a sea mist comes in. It will look amazing, right? But when you ask him who the statue represents, he's a bit cagey about that. He says, it's up to you. It's up to the visitor to decide. You can interpret it how you like.
Basically, he's giving Arthur answer.
Yeah.
Wink.
Yes, he is. But the thing is, this has kind of restarted the ongoing argument between Cornish nationalists and historians who claim that English heritage is guilty of the Disneyfication of Tintagel Castle and has completely ignored Cornish history, the true Cornish history. And the reason why they say that is because, see, I thought this was something that was part of the castle, but apparently it may not be. English Heritage unveiled a carving of Merlin's face in a rock face at the site.
But it's not Merlin's, well, it wasn't made like in Arthurian times or anything like that, was it?
No. Not as far as I know, not as far as anyone else knows. And surely, if it was in a rock face, people would have noticed it before.
Yeah, you'd think so.
So, it means that they're basically trying to impose this Arthurian legend onto Tintagel Castle. But I think the main problem here is that English Heritage are so focused on Tintagel Castle and Cornwall and Glastonbury and those areas, they're completely ignoring the snake in the grass, which is coming from Yorkshire, which is the story that we talked about before.
Which they now also have a claim on being like the true seat of King Arthur.
And the thing is, their claim might actually be more valid.
Yeah, they've actually got some historical basis.
Yeah, and it might actually be more valid than the claim that Tintagel Castle, because they basically disputed the whole idea of Tintagel Castle. And the Cornish historians are basically saying, well, look, you know, this statue is representing this Arthurian idea, but Arthur had nothing to do with Tintagel. You know, this castle had to do with this kingdom in the 6th and 7th century, and it didn't have anything to do with anything that you guys are talking about. We don't know. Why are you doing this? You know? And the reason why they're doing it is because they found bits of Mediterranean pottery and, you know, stuff like that in the area that date back to the 6th and 7th century that proved that trade was happening between that area and overseas countries.
It's somewhat flimsy.
Yes. Apparently there was a culture of feasting there, which suggests that the people who lived there were very powerful and had connections with the late Roman and Byzantine Empire.
And liked ham and jam and spam a lot.
Yes, and they think it's appropriate to speak of kings and treat that area as like a summer home, I suppose you'd call it, some kind of retreat for them on the coast. You know, like the Queen goes to spend some time at Balmoral?
Yeah, so what, Tintagel's King Arthur's beach house?
Kind of, yeah. That's what they're trying... Well, it was the beach house for the kingdom that was there at that point.
Arthur and the Knights of the Round Keg.
Yes. I mean, the kingdom was called Dumnonia.
Dumnonia?
Yes.
What kind of a name is Dumnonia?
I don't know, but it's a bit dumb.
Yeah. That's like the Chuck Tingle of castle names.
Yes, I know. So, yeah, the kingdom was called Dumnonia. And, yeah, it says here, Ashby's theory is that... who's Ashby? Basically, Jeremy Ashby, the English Heritage's head curator, has a theory that Tintagel was the summer seat of a dynasty that ruled the kingdom of Dumnonia, which stretched across Cornwall and Devon and into Somerset in the 5th, 6th and 7th centuries.
Proud kingdom of Dumnonia.
Yes, because Arthur's summer house.
Bob.
Oh.
I think the proud kingdom of Dumnonia tried to ever invade the noble Fort Pedalsmart.
Possibly. Oh. Yes, possibly, actually. If we find a fort that's called Pedalsmart, we have been proven.
Yes.
We have been vindicated.
History will prove me right.
So, yeah, that argument is ongoing, but still, there's a snake in the grass coming from Yorkshire. So, watch out, Tintagel. Watch out, English Heritage.
Meanwhile, I'm going to paint a mermaid on the side of our door because, obviously, this is the real site of Atlantis.
Yes.
And apparently that's how it works now.
Yes. Yeah, actually, that is. It's like the flag thing. You know, from.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like the flag thing. I have a flag, so now I own your country. Do you have a flag? No. Well, you can't rule here then. I have a flag. I had this made.
It's like you've got hundreds of years of civilization. Got a flag.
Anyway, moving on to Anish Kapoor. Now, artist Anish Kapoor was the guy who did the. He basically designed the Olympic Park sculpture, you know, the big one that's kind of all twisty and turny and everything that. It's called the Arcelormittal Orbit Tower, right? And he's complaining now because he's a Turner Prize winner, but he's complaining now because Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, has foisted something onto him and he's not happy about it. See, Boris has this idea that it can't simply be a work of art. It must be some kind of visitor attraction that's going to generate revenue in typical capitalist fashion.
Oh God, I'm holding a laugh in so much because I know what's coming.
So what they've done, they've basically got Carsten Holler, who is a renowned experimental artist, to design something to go around the tower. And it's basically going to be, I mean, the tower's 114 meters high. This is thing that goes around it is going to be 178 meters long. It's a tunnel slide. They're basically turning this attraction that Anish Kapoor poured his heart and soul into to design, and they're turning it into a helter-skelter.
Yes, yes, they are. It's the greatest thing ever.
And I empathize with Anish Kapoor, but I like slides.
Yeah, that's cool. I respect your rights as an artist, Anish Kapoor, but I really want to go on that slide.
Yep.
Because it's going to be so much fun.
Exactly. I'm sorry, Anish, but, you know, I just like slides.
That's why London needs to get the Olympics back.
Yes.
Can you imagine, like, standing at the top and you slide down with the flame?
Yep.
And, like, fly out and just light it on the way down.
Well, it's like, you remember they did those ball pits for adults?
Yeah.
And how many people just started queuing up for them?
Oh my God, Rob. What? Have you seen that giant structure we've got in Middlesbrough where it's like two nets?
Yes.
Giant ball pit, Rob. Oh, it needs to be a giant ball pit.
You mean
pit.
Temenos?
Yes.
Or whatever they call it.
Yeah.
I looked at it and thought, why? That was my first question when I looked at that. I went, why?
Well, now we know why. So it can be turned into a giant ball pit, Rob.
Yeah. See, the Angel of the North. Right, I kind of got that, right? It makes a statement. It makes it quite a presence on the way to Newcastle.
Looks like an angel.
Yeah.
/ upside down aeroplane.
Yes. And then someone put a giant Alan Shearer shirt on it, and that was great, because, you know, Geordies can be quite funny when they want to be. But Temenos, it's there.
Yeah, it's a giant net. I don't know why it exists.
It's supposed to represent some kind of hall gravity type thing. I don't know. There was a sign for it over near where it is explaining it. And I'm like, really? Really? Could you not just put like a black hole there then?
Maybe they did. Maybe it destroyed all of Middlesbrough. Now we haven't noticed.
Yeah. Maybe this is real life. Maybe this is fantasy.
Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality.
Open your eyes.
Look up to the skies and see.
Yes. I'm just a poor boy.
Do you get no sympathy, Rob?
No, I don't, because it's easy come.
Easy go.
Little high.
Little low.
Yes. And we're going to end that there. Right. So, any more news on that one? Because we ended with a slide, so...
Well, wow. I'm surprised, Rob, because, like, I assumed this would be news you're really excited about.
What?
And yet you keep forgetting it exists. The Wheel of Time is going to become a cutting-edge TV series.
Yes, 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 Wheel of Time. Oh, my God, yes, Wheel of Time. I've been waiting for this for God knows how long. And, right, they made this into a game. This is Robert Jordan's... It's the work of his life. It's the one that... Yes, he worked on Conan and various other things, but this is the thing that he's going to be remembered for in 100 years' time, is the Wheel of Time. Before George R. R. Martin did Game of Thrones, before J.V. Jones did Baker's Boy, and everyone else started jumping on the bandwagon of this kind of long-running, really epic, really intricate fantasy world-building, Robert Jordan came along and said, Tolkien, cha, and basically started the Wheel of Time. 13-14 books later, right? Because it is mammoth. Unfortunately, Jordan passed away, but Brandon Sanderson picked up the reins, worked from Jordan's notes, and has done a really, really good job on finishing the series off, because there was only like 2 books left in the series when Jordan died. And it's a shame he isn't alive to see the culmination of his life's work, because The Wheel of Time is actually a really, really intricate, really exceptional world. Do you know anything about the Wheel of Time?
Not a sausage.
Okay, right. The Wheel of Time is a series of books that started off with a book called The Eye of the World. Now, all of these books, for some reason, have been broken up into smaller books. Most of them have, anyway, because the original books are actually quite thick. They're about 900 pages long each.
That's a bit of a read.
Yeah, but they are really, really good and very, very detailed. Anyway, basically, a deity known as the Creator basically created the universe in the Wheel of Time, and the Creator governs all existence, that sort of thing. And each of the spokes on the wheel represents a different age. The wheel turns under the influence of something called the One Power. Now, the One Power is something like magical abilities that men and women have. And they basically have 2 sides of it. The side that the women possess is called Sidar, and the side that the men possess is called Sidin. And there's like an age of legends, and they basically have all of these kind of magicians called Aes Sedai, and they go around the world like the Jedi type thing, right? They go around the world keeping the peace, maintaining the peace. But there's a time when a guy called Lutheran Telamon, he is the leader of the Aes Sedai at that point. His previous girlfriend, because he's married and he's got kids, and the girl he was dating before, called Mirin, who becomes a character called Lanfear later on, she and some of her other cohorts, they basically found an alternate source of power called the True Power. And they're basically drilling through the planet, or the world, to basically access the True Power. But what they're actually drilling through isn't the world, they're drilling through reality. And what they're drilling to reach isn't the True Power, but something that the Creator imprisoned, the antithesis of the Creator, called Shaitan, the Dark One. And when they reach the Dark One, it starts a war that basically breaks the world. And this is the history of it. This is before the Wheel of Time starts. Oh. This is before the Eye of the World. This is the history of it. Because the first book starts off with Lutheran Telamon, and he's basically, he's gone mad, and he's holding the body of his wife, and he's wondering why she won't wake up. He is killed at that point, but there's a prophecy that says that because he's called the dragon, and there's a prophecy that says that at some point in the future, he'll walk the earth again, and that he'll basically fix the world that he broke, or that he helped to break, because in his madness, he killed everybody related to him, all his children, his wife, everybody.
What a big silly.
That's why forever his name is Kinslayer. But he did it out of madness, because what the Dark One did, before they managed to put a seal on the Dark One basically put a taint on Scythin, which all of the male Aes Sedai after that, if they keep using the power, they'll eventually go mad. So basically, in the future, it focuses on three boys who were born in the same village, right? Perrin Ibarra, Matt Cawthorn, and Randall Thor. And the three of them basically end up being the center of these massive world-changing events, because one of them is the Dragon Reborn, and I'm not going to say who.
And did they help Seal sing the Evil One back to sleep?
It's complicated. That's all I'm going to say about it. It's complicated.
Yeah, I got the gist of that point.
So, yeah, anyway, I love this series. It's one of my... You know how everyone kind of reads Game of Thrones now and everyone's going, oh, Game of Thrones is so amazing. I'm going, yeah?
Dirty fantasy hipster.
No, it's not fantasy hipster. I've just been waiting for the Wheel of Time to be made into a TV series or an animated series, because they had a game for it years ago and it was all right, but it was more of an exploration of the world rather than an actual solid game. But now with Game of Thrones being a thing, I've just been sitting there patiently waiting, and please, I beg of you, whoever's making this, please do not do what you have done to the Shannara books. Because if you do that, then me and a whole lot of other Wheel of Time fans will hunt you down.
In fact, they've actually already made a pilot.
Have they?
Yes, and it was really bad. But it's okay, because that wasn't a real pilot. Because I've been looking into the story, and like, turns out there's been a whole thing we've missed.
Oh?
It's like, apparently back in 2015, Red Eagle Entertainment, who had the rights to the series, those rights were about to expire. So, literally, they made a pilot, sent it out on FXX, which is like FX's other dumping ground channel.
Yeah.
Literally at midnight.
Yeah.
Just so they could keep the rights.
Okay.
And since then, they've probably been in this huge legal battle with Harriet McDougall, who is Robert Jordan's widow and has the rights to the books.
Yes.
But literally, what this news actually is she's kind of put a thing out on their Google Plus page saying, you know, all the legal stuff, that's resolved now. And basically, this series is going to happen.
And she's basically getting legal on people. Oh, then that gives me a lot of hope. That gives me a lot of hope, because if she's on the case, then... it basically makes me more excited for the series.
Yeah, it means she's invested in making this a good series.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, because that's what she says is, look for the official announcement coming soon from a major studio. So who knows who it could be?
AMC or HBO. That's who we're hoping for. AMC or HBO.
Come on, CBS.
No, don't you dare. Don't you jinx me.
Oh, come on, the Christian Network.
I hate you. You're ruining my dreams.
We shall seal the Dark One away using the power of the Bible.
The power of Christ compels you. Okay, on that note, I think we need to take a break.
No, the evil one is just about to, like, burst through his seal. When a Jehovah's Witness shows up and goes, do you ever been to talk about your Lord and Savior Jesus Christ? Goes, no, I'm just slams the door shut. That's it. That's how they save the day.
Oh, okay. I think on that note, we need to take a break.
Yes, we do.
We'll be back in a moment.
Hello, do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well-staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week and do it reasonably well.
And welcome back, and I've got a stuffed biscuit in my throat, help.
What?
I thought I was ready to talk, wasn't, still had biscuit, like, lodged in my throat. It's okay, it's swallowed now. That was almost the most delicious death.
Yes, yes.
But it's okay, I'm alive, and now we can talk about what we've been reading, but
I'm
not
alive,
me.
I'm alive.
I can't read books.
But I can. And
yeah, one of us is literate.
What a book I have been reading. Now, the last time I did a book, it was A Natural History of Dragons, which was a memoir by Lady Trent, Isabella, Lady Trent, or Lady Isabella Trent, whatever you want to call her. And that one dealt with her early life, right? And how she got into natural history and, you know, dragonology and stuff like that. In The Labyrinth of Drakes is basically, it's the fourth book in the series. Now, I'm going to start off with a complaint. I haven't been given book two and three, and I thought this was the second book. So I read this, and I'm going, hang on, I'm missing a bit of the story here. About two books worth of story. So thank you, Titan Books, for giving me the first and the fourth book.
But also, please don't stop sending us stuff, because we love the lovely stuff you send us.
No. I was about to say, please, can you send me the second and the third book? Because I have to say, Marie Brennan is amazing, categorically amazing. This is so good. In The Labyrinth of Drakes is just how to describe. Okay, it starts off with Isabella talking about how she got involved in a particular project. They have a thing in this book that's similar to the Royal Society, right? And they call it the Philosopher's Colloquium. And Isabella isn't a member because the Philosopher's Colloquium, just like the Royal Society of its time, you know, during Victoria times, was filled with stuffy old men who didn't think that women understood science, that kind of thing. And Isabella has been working with a guy called Thomas Wilker, and he is a good friend, a colleague, and he's very, very, very knowledgeable, but he also acknowledges just how brilliant Isabella is. Right? So, the Philosopher's Colloquium approach Thomas to do a particular job. And he says, look, I want Isabella to be on this job as well. They say, no, they offer it to somebody else who, after a year of working on it with no results, the colloquium crawl back to Thomas and say, well, yeah, we're happy to accept your conditions. But this time he's saying, because initially he said Isabella didn't need any pay because she's made loads of money from her other work anyway. But now he's saying, no, I want her on staff. She gets paid. Otherwise, I don't do it. And he's not doing it because they're in a relationship. He's doing it because she's his friend and he acknowledges just how intelligent she is.
Because she damn well deserves it.
Yeah, basically. The job in question is they have to go to a different part of the world. The military has asked for a flight of dragons and they have to breed dragons to create that flight.
That's going to work out fine, isn't it?
Yes. They're basically going to join the Royal Skirling Army in the deserts of Akia. And they're going to raise their own flight of dragons for the military. Which is easier said than done. Because they have to navigate the politics of Akia, the royalty of Akia, and various other things. See, Akia is a desert region. Very reminiscent of the Arab countries. And that's what I love about this book. It's kind of real world, but not. It's more like historical fantasy than actual outright fantasy. And I love historical fantasy.
Yeah, it basically just changes the names of places.
Yeah. So Akia is more like the Arab countries. And they had a culture in that area, in kind of the Egyptian area, I suppose Akia would be. They had an ancient civilization that worshipped dragons called the Draconians. And there Isabella meets a man called Suhail, who's an archaeologist, and he's fiercely intelligent and very, very, very knowledgeable about his subject. He knows just about everything there is to know. And in him, Isabella kind of meets a kindred spirit. It's like the two of them are two sides of the same coin. And they basically, they kind of stepping around the idea of getting married, being a couple, that sort of thing. But then later on, they do get married, but it's very, very much Isabella's decision. She, and her brother's turned up and he's kind of a, he's basically wanting to find treasure and that sort of thing. You remember, what's his face from The Mummy?
Yeah, John Hannah.
John Hannah.
Because, like, when you were telling me about him, I was thinking he sounds exactly like John Hannah from The Mummy.
Yeah, he's basically like John Hannah from The Mummy, because he's called Andrew as well, her brother.
Good name, good solid and name.
They're in this, they basically found these draconian ruins, and they're going to be exploring, but there's some kind of situation that has appeared, which I'm not going to get into because it'll spoil the book. But anyway, this situation can only be resolved in one way, because she's basically at the center of the situation. And in order to resolve it, she basically decides, right, okay, simple decision, says to Sohail, let's get married. Snap decision. Andrew, she says, you're going to be the witness to my marriage. He's like, okay. He's got no choice in it. Tom's happy to be a witness because he's her friend. So they get married, and that causes its own problems, because then the scandal of society. Oh no, she must have got married because they've obviously done the deed and she's going to be expecting in a few months.
Because of course.
Yeah, even though they haven't actually done anything. And then they make
that's
a discovery.
Never stopped the gossip papers before, has it?
No, it hasn't. But then Isabella and Sohail and Tom and Andrew make a discovery. And it's a discovery that it's possibly the greatest archaeological discovery of the century. But Isabella actually makes two discoveries in this book, and one of them is much, much, much bigger than the other one. The archaeological discovery is one thing, right? Greatest archaeological discovery of the century, possibly the greatest of the age. They've found complete remains of the Draconian civilization, you know, murals, gold, everything, you know, like breaking open Tutankhamun's tomb. But what they've also found was a special birthing chamber for dragons.
Ooh.
Yeah. So that's a bit of a spoiler, sorry. But the second discovery, I'm not going to explain. Suffice to say, it's world-changing. Because of the first discovery, Isabella and Sohail, Isabella primarily, she's given a barony of the area of Trend. And so she changes her surname to Trent, and Sohail changes his surname to Trent, just so that they can, you know, be together and that there's no friction going forward. So it's Isabella and Sohail Trent from then.
So I suppose like Lord and Lady Trent.
Yeah, Lord and Lady Trent. And she's basically, she's gone from being this scandalous woman who got married to this man, obviously they've done the deed, to being the romance of the century.
Which is, of course, completely unrealistic, and nothing like that would ever happen in our modern society.
Oh, no, nothing like that would happen, Kate Middleton.
Cough, cough.
Yes. So basically, it's remarkable just how much times don't change. But Isabella Trent, my God, how I wish she was a real person. She was an actual historical figure, because Marie Brennan has brought this character to life in a way that is, you just fall in love with her as a person. It's not that you want to basically marry her or date or anything like that, but you just love to spend an afternoon just listening to her about her adventures.
Preferably in the garden with an ornate tea set.
Yes. Marie Brennan, my hat is firmly doffed. It is off completely to you. You have done something amazing. And when I spoke about the first book, A Natural History of Dragons, I had a big smile plastered on my face,
didn't
I?
You did.
How is my smile right now?
I'm worried. Your cheeks seem to be like snapping under the pressure.
It's because these are so good. And I would recommend these books to anybody. Let's put it this way. If you have any kind of love for dragons, then you need to read these books. It's that simple.
And I do have a love for dragons. So then I think I'm going to have to read these books at some point.
Yes, you do. If you have any love for dragons, then you need to read these books. And the artwork is still amazing.
Yes, yes, it is. The lovely anatomical, that's the word.
Yes.
Anatomical designs of dragons.
Oh, yes, but that's not the best bit. They have some really amazing, because you can tell that the Draconian civilization is supposed to be Egypt, right? Because of things like that.
Oh, yeah, that's hella Egyptian.
Yeah. And then there's a picture of Sohail in here, so you actually get a look at the guy in question.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, and it's somewhere in here. I'll find it later and show you. But yeah, the artwork is just these little pages as you're reading through, and suddenly there's a piece of art, and you go, "Ooh, that's rather nice." But still, the anatomical dragons—that's a drake. But the anatomical drakes and dragons are just the best.
They are lovely.
And I love this one because it's actually got the three stages of the drake. You've got the adult, the young adult, and then the hatchling. So, yeah. In the Labyrinth of Drakes by Marie Brennan. It deserves all the praise it's been getting. Thoroughly deserves all the praise it's been getting.
Nice. I look forward to reading it soon.
Yes. Yes, you will. Anyway, we're going to finish on a couple of things very quickly. We'll run through these.
Yes, a couple more stories we found.
Yes.
Sort of in the break.
The first one is that the Brontes, the Charlotte Bronte 200th anniversary, they're actually explaining how the Brontes created a completely secret Game of Thrones-style world, or Lord of the Rings-style world. And this was long before Guru Martin created Westeros or Tolkien created Middle-earth. They basically created a world where there was the dual kingdoms of Angria and Gondal, and they were collectively known as the Glass Tower Federation. And Branwell and Charlotte, Branwell Bronte, who was the brother of the Bronte sisters, Branwell and Charlotte conjured the kingdom of Angria, whilst Emily and Anne concocted Gondal, and together they wrote hundreds of poems and prose based on their creations, lengthy sagas contained in handwritten books and magazines.
That's actually crazy.
Yeah. Their first creation was Glasstown, whose inhabitants consisted of a mixture of both fictional and real-life figures. The Duke of Wellington, for example, featured in Charlotte and Branwell's The Young Men's Magazine, whose titular characters were inspired by 12 wooden soldiers gifted to Branwell by their father. And this is all done in microscript, intended to be the creations of the toy soldiers. And this is the kind of thing that the Brontes did. This just kind of shows just how prolific they were. Not just the sisters, but Branwell as well.
Yeah, that they had a huge sweeping fantasy world as just a thing they did on the side.
Yes. And they had poems and sagas and everything.
That is insane.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Anyway, that's the first story. But the second one, this one is just the perfect way to round off this show. The most ridiculous adult colouring books. And by adult, I mean for adults. I don't mean like as in adult, as in nude.
Yes. As in naughty nudity. Times.
Yeah, as in naughty
The Chuck
times.
Tingle colouring book.
Yeah, Chuck Tingle sexy time colouring book. I think
of course, it's sequel pounded in the butt by my own colouring book.
Yes. Anyway, we know that the adult colouring book market has exploded. And we don't really understand why. Let's start off with the list. Now, you only know one from this list.
I do, and that one is already something I want more than I've ever wanted anything in my life.
It's a Bill Murray colouring book.
Yes.
Called Thrill Murray. And it's 23 pages long, and it's the actor in all his movies, and he's just waiting for a splash of colour. So there's a picture of him from Lost in Translation when he's in Japan, various things like that. There is the Swear Word colouring book, which is zero Fs given.
Wait, so you have to fill it in entirely yourself then?
Yes. Zero Fs given. Now, there is a series that includes Unicorns Are Jerks and Dinosaurs with Jobs, right? And they have they've added to that series with a body positive covering book by Nicole Lorenz called Fat Ladies in Space. And it's 18 fat sci-fi heroines doing what they do best, trekking across time and space, blasting off into the adventure and saving the day.
Because they see me floating, they hate him.
Yes. The 1990s colouring book, which I don't understand.
I assume it's for fat minds.
Yes. The Great British Cake Off colouring book.
Cake Off?
Yes.
Basically, is this like a non-copyright infringement bake-off?
No. It's 100%. Oh, no, yeah. It's 100% official. And you basically add colour to the cakes. Colour Me Good Swoon, which is George Clooney, James Franco, Matt Damon, Daniel Craig, Colin Firth, Richard Gere, Jude Law, Michael Fassbender. It's heartthrobs galore, plus some cringeworthy chat-up lines.
Well, it's a good thing I wouldn't want something like that. Was it available from where I need it right now?
Yeah. And the colouring book for lawyers, for people whose black, grey and brown colouring pencils are always the ones they in need of a sharpen. The Candy Crush colouring book, because the game wasn't addictive enough.
Well, and just because it needs to slowly rise until it dominates us all.
Yeah. Thing is, this kind of highlights just how ridiculous the colouring book market is getting. Because, I mean, what's the worst colouring book you could think of for them?
Colouring book where the Grey Cloud colouring book. Page after page of grey clouds.
Oh, you silly goose.
Am I not even close?
The Cronenberg colouring book.
No! Oh, God. Oh, no. No. I don't want to hail the new flesh.
And now that I've said it, someone's going to make it.
God, I don't think we'd have enough post-green pens for the fly page.
Oh, there's also the David Lynch colouring book. someone's going to do a Die Hard colouring book.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure the David Lynch colouring book is you open it up and it's a blank page.
Yeah.
And then someone runs in and just like slaps a blue paintbrush across your face and runs out.
Yes. The Tarantino colouring book. Make sure you have lots of red.
Yes.
Lots of red. Lots of red.
So
all of
red.
The red.
Lars von Trier colouring book.
Yes. Yes. That one must be done. That one must be done. The Stellan Skarsgård colouring book. It's just pictures of Stellan Skarsgård from from all of the movies and TV shows he's been in. But he always looks the same. He's always got the same expression. Yeah. That slightly... that he's got that part of his lip raised up a little bit when he's kind of annoyed or tetchy or something like that, or happy or sad or hungry.
It's just like the same picture of his head copy and pasted onto every page.
Yes, basically. Stellan Skarsgård in The Avengers, Stellan Skarsgård in River. And you can do the same with Liam Neeson. Oh, no, because in some of them, Liam Neeson is going to have long hair.
Exactly. No, that's too much variety, Rob.
No, because Liam Neeson has long hair in The Phantom Menace. Liam Neeson in The Phantom Menace. Liam Neeson in Taken. Liam Neeson in Next of Kin, where he looks like a hobo.
Go have Liam Neeson in The Deadpool.
Yes.
With his magnificent ponytail.
Yes. Yes, you can.
So you joke, but I want that coloring book now.
Yeah. And obviously there's going to be others for the science fiction fan in you. You can have Spock Through the Ages. I don't know. Richard Dean Anderson.
Spock Through the Ages. And it's like one facial expression. But then on the last page you get a special surprise and it's him with a single eyebrow raised.
Yes. And then there's a super secret page, which is just basically that panel where he beats Wolverine with a Vulcan neck pinch.
Can we have another secret panel of just him sobbing mathematically?
Yes. Yes. No. He's crying to Fibonacci. 1, 2, 1, 1, 2. It could be done. Anyway, on that note, I think we'll end the show.
I think we should.
We've got to the end. So we've safely reached the final point. So we're going to leave you for another week. Next week, I think you've got that that Roma book, haven't you?
Indeed, I theoretically have Clash of Eagles next week.
Yes.
Dependent on my ability to actually read the words within it.
Anyway, until then, I have been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all next week.
Thanks for listening.